Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee, live in Paris every week with a panel of distinguished correspondents discussing the biggest stories of the past 7 days. Our programme now selected as one of the best 100 podcasts in the world for current affairs too. So thank you for watching. In a week that President Trump made the first overseas tour of his second term, where Riyadh royalty rolled out a lavender carpet ahead of a $600 billion pledge of Saudi investment for US contracts. Qatar next, the beast surrounded by a caravan of camels, while the man inside watched a ceremonial sword fair spectacle. Then onwards to the UAE, to the sound of drums and the swishing of hair. Yeah, more big money deals too that were announced. A trip that made headlines for a surprise meeting with Syria's warlord turned president, and questions over why Trump left Israel off the itinerary, and on the ethics of accepting the gift of a winged palace from Doha.
So they said to me, we would like to, in effect, we would like to make a gift. You've done so many things, and we'd like to make a gift to the Defense Department, which is where it's going. And I said, well, that's nice. Now, some people say, oh, you shouldn't accept gifts for the country. My attitude is, why wouldn't I accept a gift? We're giving to everybody else. Why wouldn't I accept a gift?
It's been a week where President Zelensky called President Putin's bluff. He was awaiting talks in Turkey, the setting the Russian leader had chosen for negotiations, rather than accepting an unconditional ceasefire. Putin was a no-show. Stand-in prop sent instead, said Kyiv. Moscow had barely the time to call Zelensky a clown in response by the time President Trump intervened. Nothing's going to happen, he suddenly declared to reporters, until Putin and I get together. We'll assess when and where the stage is being set for that.
We need to understand what kind of level the Russian delegation is and what mandate they have and whether they can make any decisions.
And it's a week where the 78th Cannes Film Festival kicked off. Juliette Binoche heads up this year's jury. A new dress code too. No nudity or voluminous gowns. And honorary Palme d'Or too, already awarded to Robert De Niro, who used the acceptance speech to criticise President Trump. And the big tip for this year's Best Film Award is the subtle Japanese drama Renoir. To my grand jury, the distinguished panellists joining me on tonight's programme. We go to Istanbul, joined by a great friend of the programme, the three times Pulitzer Prize finalist and independent international correspondent, Borzu Daragahi. Good evening, Borzu.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, I remember, Borzu, last time we spoke several months ago, we talked about the chat GPTization or things of grokification, if that's a word of things as well. This week, Google is launching Gemini, its AI kids edition for under 13s. And I note from your social media, you've already had the email advertising its services and what appears to be an opt-out letter, not an opt-in one. And you've raised a number of ethical questions about it.
Oh, that's an interesting question to put to me. Yeah, I think that this is just a leap into the unknown. And I've mentioned this on this show before. I've written about this before. We are entering this new age where we're handing these, you know, rather sketchy oligarchs control of some of the most crucial aspects of our civilization and our humanity with very little public discussion, with very little regulation. And it's dangerous and it's risky, and there should be at least some discussion about it before we give these people who are so unaccountable and have such bad track records so much power.
It is very interesting, and to which UNICEF recently said that there should be for AI and chatbots a minimum age of 13 years old. So this coming at a time seeming counter to that. It's going to be brought out first in the US and in Australia too, because it doesn't count as part of the social media laws where there is a minimum age being brought in of 16 because it's a chatbot is considered different. Great to have you with us, Borzu, on that issue as well. Let's go to Kyiv. Let's bring in Janine DiGiovanni, seasoned war correspondent, award-winning author of 9 books, including The Morning They Came For Us, Dispatches from Syria, and CEO of The Reckoning Projects, which trains journalists in documenting war crimes in Ukraine and the Middle East. Janine, it is great to see you. Tell me about your week this week in Ukraine.
Well, I've just arrived. I'm on my way to Kharkiv with my team. We are still looking at the deported Ukrainian children, 19,000 of them that have been taken by Russia, brought to inside Russia to be forcibly adopted, but also part of a larger scheme to basically take away these kids' Ukraine identity. Their names are changed, their birth certificates are taken away, they're placed with Russian families. And this really is part of a scheme to take away their future. Given what happened today in Istanbul, people are exhausted here, they're tired of 3 years of war, but they're saying, we will not give in, not ever, to our demands for territorial integrity. They do not want to give up 18% of their country.
Very interesting. And also, on the issue of those children taken, the triage of information that we get, it's often that it sort of comes somewhere underneath the headlines of a ceasefire. Very interesting, it was mentioned recently as a priority by Pope Leo XIV as something that has to be done in the immediate term. Janine, great to have you with us tonight. With me in the studio, as well as Janine out there in Ukraine, we have the intrepid reporter, Europe correspondent for Swiss media outlet Blick. It's Richard Worley, spent the 90s covering the Far East, conflicts in Cambodia, Burma, was stationed as correspondent in Bangkok and Tokyo as well. And this week, Richard, you've just come back from assignment in the US. What have you been looking at?
Well, correct. I've been there initially for the 100 days of Trump, spending those days in Washington, D.C., and then flying to Colorado to report on migrants. You know, near Denver, in the vicinity of Denver, you have one of the biggest detention facility for migrants in the U.S., in Aurora. That's the name of the town. So I went there, spoke to the people. At the time, they were deporting those migrants to Salvador and other countries. So that was really interesting. And then I proceeded with West Virginia, tracking J.D. Vance's childhood. You know, he's written a book, Hillbilly Elegy. The book is published in France. It's actually selling well in France, and I wanted to see whether what he says in the book corresponded to the reality there.
And before you came in, you said to me, I was in his childhood home.
Correct, in northeast Kentucky. I mean, in this Appalachian region, which is really unknown in France, where you have this mining tradition, this wide community, and they will tell you that for them, it's all about work, family and religion. That's what I was told all along the Appalachian Trail. But still, the story said and told by J.D. Vance doesn't completely correspond to reality. He had this tendency to portray this region as really miserable, as a place where people are destituted. It's not always true. So he painted it in a way that helped him in his political career.
There's a million questions that are springing off. I'm sure people watching are thinking the same thing. What were you doing in the childhood home? Who's living there now? Is it a museum? Were you invited in?
I'll tell you. To tell you the things very bluntly, it's a slum now. When you look at the childhood house, it's full of things left over, an old barbecue, an old washing machine. Why? Because the house, which was the house of his great-grandmother, is inhabited by a cousin of him, an estranged cousin. She didn't want to attend the inauguration while her children went to the inauguration. And I think it's a way for her to protest against J.D. Vance. Oh. So I don't recommend to go there except to take photographs. She lives in a trailer and she said proudly, I am a Democrat. But then she continued, probably the only Democrat in a vicinity of 20 kilometres.
Wow. What a story. Don't let Donald Trump know about that. That is a prospect opportunity.
And she doesn't want to be photographed. You can photograph the house, but not her.
Brilliant. Great story. Great to have you with us. Also worth saying as well, Rich is the author of The Ball of Illusion, What France Believes and What the World Sees. So that gets us the ball rolling tonight. We also have Ketevan Gojestani, our international affairs editor. Ketevan, former Washington correspondent as well. And I am minded to say that when we watched this first trip of Trump's second term in office, did you have FOMO that you would have wished to have been on Air Force One?
I mean, it looked like a grueling 4 days, and they were actually joking on Air Force One between the president and the reporters that were following him in the pool. He said, you guys have good stamina, and so it looked like it was a hard one. But I did follow almost every minute very closely, reporting on it from here and talking about all the different steps and different legs since he took off from Washington. So not too much FOMO.
Okay, and a key person to be with us tonight as well. It was King Khalid Airport, Riyadh, at 10 to 10 in the morning that Air Force One touched down and President Trump received a very royal welcome. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman personally greeting the president. He was then escorted to the royal court for a traditional Arabic coffee. and she didn't drink. Onwards to the Ritz, where in came Elon Musk, leading a US business delegation alongside key Saudi ministers. A sense of the enterprise behind the scenes about to be made public.
Exactly 8 years ago this month, I stood in this very room and looked forward to a future in which the nations of this region would drive the forces of terrorism and extremism, drive them right out of existence, and take your place among the proudest, most prosperous, most successful nations anywhere in the world as leaders of a modern and rising Middle East. So exciting. So exciting. Mohammed, do you sleep at night? How do you sleep? Huh? Just think it. What a job. He tosses and turns like some of us. Tosses and turns all night. How do I make it even better all night? It's the ones that don't toss and turn. They're the ones that will never take you to the promised land, won't they?
It was a 50-minute speech full of praise for the Crown Prince, for his own administration and for the arms deal that he was announcing as well. $142 billion of Saudi investment, part of a total of $600 billion package, said the White House. And to top it off, he finished by introducing his friend, the Crown Prince, to the stage, to YMCA. Borzu, a word on the first leg. That bit was particularly awkward, wasn't it?
I mean, you have to note the irony of an LGBT anthem being used by, you know, in a country that is, you know, I mean, the village people are famously very, very gay. And this is a country where homosexuality is outlawed and gays are flogged, if not worse. So I think that's pretty important to note, I guess. But I would also just say that a lot of these deals, if you look at the fine print, they are memorandums of understanding. And a lot of them were also just deals that have been in the works for some time that Trump is taking credit for. And also there's certain things that are like the UAE has always wanted chips from NVIDIA, from that advanced chip maker there. Yeah, they've been coveting having a status as an AI hub, so to speak. And the Biden administration was very concerned about transferring that technology, and Trump just okayed it. So these are things that would have happened. They're not, a lot of them are, maybe there were some new deals forged, but a lot of the stuff is either very thin memorandums of understanding that are not enforceable, or deals that were long in the works.
It's very different as well. You've reported a lot on this in the past. A very different relationship between the Crown Prince with this president than his predecessor. I think last time there was issue whether over the handshake, they ended up doing a fist bump in the end, President Biden. There was the focus on Jamal Khashoggi, the killed as where you are in Istanbul at the Saudi embassy, the consulate there. That's notable too, isn't it?
I mean, the issue of human rights, though, you can't even talk about it with the Trump administration and increasingly with Republicans in general, except when it comes to, you know, countries they don't like Iran or North Korea. But, you know, the hypocrisy on the human rights stance with regard to most Republicans is sort of evened out with the Trump administration because they're not really hypocrites about human rights. They bluntly don't care about issues such as that.
Richard, you're just back, as you said, from the States. This is about what Trump can take away, isn't it? What he can show as a trophy cabinet, the immediacy of something instantly tangible.
You're right. It's about the number of zero on the check. That's all. And when I was in the US, you know, the controversy about the plane that was given to Qatar, the presidential plane, I asked several of my American friends, are you shocked by that, the fact that a country, Qatar, is offering the presidential jet? And those people I was speaking to were saying, no, they should give two because there is a need for a replacement plane whenever Donald Trump travels. So I think we live now in a different world in many parts of the USA where this argument made by Donald Trump that everything is about money, everything should translate into check, everything should translate into investment, even, and that was said, even if it's only a memorandum of understanding, for the people there in the US, especially when Fox News report about it, it is seen as contract, as investment, as something which is done. And what can you say against that? You talk to people and they say, you see, whenever he travels, he brings money back. Mm. And that's the good news. So I think money remain at the moment his best argument.
And there's a lot to consider here. To break it down, I think, chronologically, given the scope of the week and given the effects and ripple effects politically of what's just happened in these 4 days, ethically, as Richard talked about, economically as well. So before moving on to the second leg in Qatar, President Trump met Syria's leader. It was a will-he-won't-he moment. The American president shaking hands with a former al-Qaeda operative who, up until 5 months ago, had a $10 million bounty on his head. He was wanted in the US. But that was before his Islamist rebel group HTS had toppled the dictator, President Bashar al-Assad, and one that's emerged, this still image of the meeting, Trump telling reporters it was, quote, an attractive guy, very strong past. He was a fighter, adding that he's got a real shot of holding it together. Janine, Syria is a huge part of your life. You've covered the conflict since 2012. Tell me what you've made of the significance of this moment.
Yeah, and I just got back from Syria. So this is a real turning point. It's definitely a major policy shift. It's a huge moment for Syria. With the lifting of the sanctions, 90% of the country, remember, lives on the poverty line. 25% are jobless. So this is going to have a huge impact on them. When I was in Syria, I mean, buying a sandwich on the street requires having a huge amount of cash on you. Everything is so expensive, incredibly expensive. So this is really giving the Syrian people a moment when they're saying, okay, things are going to turn. The lifting of the EU, the UK, and now the US sanctions is, I mean, I hate to quote Trump, but a chance at greatness. It also means that they can get foreign assistance, a lifting of the arms ban, and economic interaction with the US. So this is something they have been looking for a long time. I think that, you know, we need to give Syria a chance right now. Mm. It's a critical moment. It's a really important moment when they need this more than anything. Already, the Syrian pound has strengthened against the dollar by 25%. But there is one thing that's really important, and I have to stress this, corruption. We've got to keep a really close eye on corruption, on economic reforms. And I always look back to Bosnia post-war, where I covered the war in Bosnia for years, but in the aftermath, the amount of money that was poured into Bosnia that then disappeared. So we can't make the same mistake with Syria, although I am hugely in favor of giving this new government a chance. I think they're trying. I think they're trying to be inclusive of more women. I think they're trying to work with the Kurds. And I think that this is a moment that they need our support to get on their feet after decades and decades of repressive and authoritarian regime by the Assad family.
And those conversations you're having on the streets, Janine, given that you've been back and forth there for so many years, how different are they now? To what extent do people feel like whatever happens is better than what came before that? And to what extent do people feel, in conversation, still fearful about what could come?
No, it's unbelievable because I spent years taking testimony in Syria during the war on both sides, on the Assad side until I got kicked out in 2013, and then from the rebel side where I crossed numerous times through Aleppo. People were terrified even then, even on the opposition side, to talk about the crimes committed by the Assad family. They were scared. This time, not only I interviewed prisoners who were released. I interviewed a lot of chemical weapon victims whose entire families have been wiped out. I went to Homs, I went to Hama, I went to Diraya, I went to Tadamon, I went to Western Ghouta, Damascus, throughout the country. I was shocked at how freely people wanted to tell me about what happened to them during the Assad regime. I actually said, you don't have to give me your name. You don't know what's going to happen. Let's like be cool about this. No, they said, we want our voices to be heard. Mm. We have been silenced for so long. Wow. But what's really important to remember is that in Iraq, and Borzu was there with me in the Saddam years and in the fall of Saddam, people couldn't speak so freely for a long time. the trauma they endured took them, for me anyway, months and months and months after the fall of Saddam to still get people to give testimony to the horrors that they had experienced. So I have to say, this trip to Syria, where we're going to launch a program, the Reckoning Project, was extraordinary to hear people coming out from years of fear, repression, trauma, to tell their stories.
Really interesting to hear, Janine. Just listening to that, Ketevan, I'm interested from when you, what you're hearing, two things actually. One on the sanctions being lifted, the kind of feeling from both the Democrats and the Republicans, are there outspoken voices against that idea? And also to Richard's points a moment ago as well, the idea of this winged palace being offered by Qatar, there is some resistance to that, not just by the Dems, but on the Republican side too.
Yes, on the flying palace, what was interesting was that obviously, and no surprise there, the Democrats were up in arms talking about corruption, how this was against the Constitution, because there's Article 1, the Foreign Emoluments Clause, that says you cannot get a gift from a foreign leader or foreign state without the express consent of a Congress. What was more surprising was the reaction of a lot of Republicans, actually. It was not one that is always critical of Donald Trump. It was a few Republicans on the Hill, both in the House and in the Senate, who were expressing a really unease about this gift. Some were focusing on the security aspect and the risk of espionage, saying it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars if you need to strip that plane to make sure that it is clean and to then refurbish it with all the elements that the Air Force One has. It is basically a flying Oval Office.
Yes.
So you had that, the security aspect, but there are some Republicans who are saying, look, this at the very least is an appearance of impropriety. Whether or not there is, qui pro quo, it doesn't matter. It's not okay to have that. And then what was even more surprising was the reaction from MAGA sphere on social media, those big influencers that have a big voice in the MAGA world, like Laura Loomer, who has been very important in Donald Trump's year. She came out on social media saying, if this is true and this actually happened, it will be a stain on this administration. And she added, this comes from someone who would take a bullet for Donald Trump. And she's not the only one. Ben Shapiro, a lot of these people have been criticizing that because Qatar, they associate with the support to Hamas. And they're saying, how can we get a gift? It's not that they don't like gifts. They don't like gifts from Qatar.
Associated with Qatar, Hamas also associated with Iran as well. Bozu, also, what do you make separately on the issue, not just on the plane, but going back to what Janine said on the sanctions as well, that Israel is making of this moment, Syria's leader giving the official US seal of approval in a country where Israeli forces have been busy bombing in previous weeks?
I mean, it's an awkward moment for Israel. There does appear to be some a distance between the Trump administration and Israel on many issues. The Trump administration is also pursuing talks with Iran, with the Houthis, and over Gaza without Israeli input, without Israeli direct participation. And this is being picked up by the Israeli press as a kind of snub. There's others who are saying that Trump is playing a sort of game with Netanyahu. But I think that he sees an advantage here. Trump sees an advantage in pursuing diplomatic solutions on longstanding problems. He might even see that Israel is kind of a roadblock to some of those problems. There were reports that a senior official was demoted over allegations that he was colluding with Netanyahu to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran. I think that Trump is sensitive to the idea that he's anyone's dupe, whether that's Putin or Netanyahu.
I want to talk also briefly about handshaking this week. President Trump is on the record saying over the years he doesn't like it. He told Matt Frye at Channel 4 News, it was, quote, not a great custom. It's been proven that someone has a horrible cold. All of a sudden you have, well, science proves him right, he said. And spare a thought for what we're seeing here. This is the shake-a-thon in Riyadh going on. This went on and on, Richard. He was clearly putting on a brave face if he wasn't enjoying it.
Well, when you want to receive big checks, there is always a price to pay. And in this case, the handshake was the price of the check. That's the way it is. And Trump is a seller after all, so we understand that's the price of the deal, yeah, in a way. But he didn't seem to be very comfortable throughout the ceremonies in Saudi Arabia. From the very beginning, he didn't drink that coffee that normally you would drink. Apparently, he fell asleep at some point. So I don't think that for him it was a great moment. The only great moment, I believe, was when the Prince bin Salman confirmed that he will do this investment of $600 billion, I believe that's the figure, in the US. He seemed to be, Donald Trump, much more at ease in the UAE. But it's also true that you have always the time difference issue. And keep in mind that he is 78 years old.
And he is a germaphobe. He has said it himself back in his first term. He's even before COVID, he's someone who, if he can avoid it, will avoid a handshake. So this is really something tough for him to do.
This is okay. Well, let's just whiz through the rest of the tour because some significant issues did happen. We talked about the Doha winged palace. Day two, Trump arrived at Hamad International Airport, Doha, Qatar. 300,000 people in a country that's emerged as a key broker in the attempts for a Gaza ceasefire, where senior Hamas political leaders, as we mentioned, have been based. After meeting US troops based there and attending a banquet, President Trump brought along the head of Boeing to his meeting with the Emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, and came out with a deal worth $100 billion. Qatar Airways making a reported record offer of buying 160 Boeing jets. There were ethical questions, we said, about the business empire, his plans for a $5 billion beachside golf resort in Qatar, announced by Trump's sons this month as well. There are many headlines of political and ethical significance. I also want to talk about something else that wasn't on the itinerary, Janine, and that was Israel. There are reports that Israeli diplomats were trying to talk to Trump's team up until the moment he set off to the Middle East, saying, add us to the agenda. He said, no, now's not the right trip. It has to be separate. What do you make of that?
I thought it was extraordinary. Netanyahu was sidelined. And I have to say there was something quite satisfying about it, in the same way when Obama sidelined him in 2009. But what I'm thinking, is this somehow a shift in Middle East policy? So this week we saw Thomas Friedman, who's a leading Jewish voice for the New York Times, who grew up as a Zionist, writing an op-ed, Israel is not our ally. And I think that was hugely significant. The head of Ben and Jerry's, Ben Cohen, was then arrested on the floor of the Senate for speaking out about Gaza. I feel as though, with The Economist publishing this week that the figures in Gaza are probably 100,000 dead rather than 55,000, which we originally thought, I feel as though there is a shift that is coming. Now, whether or not Trump is just absolutely frustrated with Bibi calling the shots, or is he, I don't think he ethically feels much concern for the Gazan people. I think it is more about whether or not there is a shift in America. I was in America 2 weeks ago to see some of our donors and our supporters, and I felt, just talking to people, especially in New York, which of course is traditionally pro-Israel, pro-Netanyahu, people were getting sickened by the images they were seeing from Gaza. It's now been 10 weeks since food, since water, since humanitarian aid have been allowed to cross the border. Now, this is no longer a question of people saying, well, what about Hamas? What about the hostages? These are now civilians who are starving to death. Even leading Holocaust scholars are now calling it a genocide. We're no longer saying a plausible genocide. We are calling it a genocide. So I think, not that Trump cares about his image, these voices in some way are reaching him.
It's a very...
And something has got to shift in Gaza.
It is a term more frequently being used, Ginny, as you say. I think in Gaza, the two significant figures have used the term genocide this week. Josep Borrell, the former EU Foreign Affairs Chief, and Tom Fletcher as well, the UN's Human Rights Chief, in remarks to the UN Security Council. And he defended saying they'd prevent against genocide by saying this, quote, we're making sure we aren't making the same mistake that was made with previous massive breaches of international law, where it hasn't been called out soon enough. What's your take on that, Ketevan?
Well, I think what was interesting also to just to double up on what Janine said is that the shift that you see in the sort of policy, you also saw in Donald Trump actually talking about the Palestinian people and what was happening in Gaza. And of course, Donald Trump is famous for always listening to the last person who has his ear. And he was, during this trip, surrounded by people who have been strong supporters of the Palestinian cause, of the Palestinian people. And the fact that he came out in public to talk about the humanitarian situation in Gaza was actually, he didn't say anything about what he was going to do, but the simple fact that he mentioned it was already a huge change of tone, at least. And Donald Trump may not ethically care about the Palestinian people. He also is not ideologically in support of Israel the way some people in his administration are, who are actual Zionists, who are very supportive of Israel. For example, the one he named, Mike Huckabee, as ambassador in Israel, who is an outspoken Zionist. Donald Trump wants what's good for the Americans. And right now, maybe he looks at Israel and he doesn't see what he can get out of supporting Israel up front.
Hence, going back to the itinerary, to which was no instant tangible goals to bring back. Israel notably rejecting any accusations of genocide. It says it respects international law, has a right to defend itself, particularly with what happened in regard to October the 7th. Meanwhile, the ICJ and the ICC are investigating genocide or war crime allegations against the government of Israel and the Israeli Prime Minister, respectively, both involved in the evidence-gathering stage at this stage. Next Saturday morning in Kyiv, Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer said, quote, "We're calling Putin out," as he stood alongside Emmanuel Macron, Friedrich Merz and Donald Tusk on a European solidarity trip to meet President Zelensky. "Agree to an immediate ceasefire tomorrow," he said, "or there'll be further sanctions. The US is with us too," they said, called President Trump, meanwhile, on a conference call to prove the point. President Putin responded early hours Sunday, gaslighting, game-playing, no mention of a ceasefire, but creating a new path to a truce with a direct meeting arranged in Turkey for Thursday. He didn't say he'd be there, but President Zelensky did, and come Tuesday was waiting in Ankara, calling the Kremlin's bluff. Moscow was accused of sending a dummy delegation, a low-level team, sans Putin. Diplomacy turned to insults. The Kremlin called Ukraine's leader a clown, a loser, and the goalposts shifted again. President Trump saying on his plane, as we heard, nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together. Borzu, no extra sanctions, no ceasefire. President Trump talking about this Trump-Putin get-together. Where do you think President Zelensky factors in all of this?
I think that's an interesting question. I think Zelensky is holding his own. He's building credibility with the Europeans. Trump is has avowedly and famously kind of ditched the Ukrainian cause. There are institutional factors in the U.S. that have block that, so to speak, and that includes, you know, very influential members of Congress as well as the security establishments. They support very much Ukraine and will resist any attempt by Trump to hand parts of Ukraine to Russia. The idea that Russia is not interested in peace, it jives with history. This, especially with Putin, Russia does not have a great track record on honesty. It has ended wars when it has lost them, and that goes for centuries. So I think that if you're any student of Russian history will know that any attempt at a kind of negotiated honorable settlement will not be possible with this Russia especially.
And one thing that strikes me, Janine, just listening to Borzu there, it begs the question, doesn't it? Why hasn't Trump, quote, gotten together with Putin yet? And at the same time, I don't know if you're hearing this in Kyiv as well, there are reports of a major Russian offensive starting in the next few weeks to take more of Ukraine. And I just wonder to the extent that is being reflected where you are as well.
Absolutely. Look, I've gone through three Putin wars, Chechnya, Syria, and now Ukraine. You can't call Putin's bluff. I think it's kind of absurdity to think that. Even while talk was going on of a ceasefire, he was mobilizing 120,000 more soldiers, raising the monthly fee that they would be paid, and making more plans for furthering the war. Now, on the other side, with the Ukrainians, I constantly have conversations with Ukrainians from all levels of society, my team, but also analysts, journalists, ordinary people. What would it take to end this war? Would you give up Crimea? The answer is always no. The answer is always that in 1991, when a referendum was called, nearly all of the population of Ukraine said that they wanted their sovereignty. So after 3 years of really bitter fighting, where, you know, you cannot drive through a village in Ukraine without seeing pictures of soldiers that had been killed. And remember that the mobilization in Ukraine, the way it works is that when you're sent to the front line, you're there for 3 years. So these guys and these women have been there for 3 years. Mm. Do you think they're going to give up 18% of their country? No. So, I mean, there is a real stalemate here, but I do want to point out one thing, the prisoner swap. So yeah, we do have to think that even though we can say the talks have been a joke, my friends here are saying it's been completely ridiculous. There are 1,000 prisoners that are going to be swapped. Now, that is something. So I do want to point that out. But whether or not we're any closer to a ceasefire, no. Mm. And in fact, we do believe that Putin is getting ready for another full-on bigger launch to the conflict.
And meanwhile, Richard, it feels like the world is being strung along, doesn't it, with President Trump not appearing to show any urgency in putting significant pressure on Putin. And is Trump being made to look a fool here? And what his team seem to say is, no, he's wearing Putin down.
Well, my impression is that Trump still wants the photo opportunity with Putin. He wants his summit with Vladimir Putin. He has sold that to his American public opinion, to the American public opinion and to his electorate. And for him, and he said it in the plane, I believe in the presidential plane, he said that no peace can happen, nothing can happen if I don't meet personally Vladimir Putin. So what we are seeing at the moment is the preparation. He probably thought that he would meet Putin earlier, but Putin made it impossible by refusing to make any concession. But in Donald Trump's minds, it is still him who lead the show and him who will make peace possible. Is it true or not? Then that's another question. But he will try, I believe, to have this meeting with Putin. And the only hope I have, but I'm not an expert neither on Putin's temper nor on Russia, is that to meet Donald Trump, Putin will have to make a concession and maybe a significant concession. But it's true that when you see the deployment of troops and the risk of another offensive, we have all to be very careful. Remember, Trump met with Kim Il-sung in North Korea and it didn't have any effect. And North Korea is more threatening today than it was 10 years ago.
That's why there's credit to you as an intrepid reporter, not only in the childhood home of J.D. Vance, but also attempting to get inside the mind of President Trump, which is a challenge in itself.
But Ketevan knows better.
Well, this is my point. If there is a point, it looks clear that Putin isn't going to play the game, not just to people in the room and in Europe, but to the White House. What is the strategy? Do you have a sense, is it walk away? Is it increase sanctions?
Look, it's unclear what exactly Donald Trump wants to do next. What appears to be the case right now is that he hasn't reached the point where he's willing to just go full force on those sanctions, even though earlier today, Europeans were sitting down in Albania with Zelensky. They called Donald Trump, and according to Keir Starmer, they agreed that Russia's requests and conditions were unacceptable, and they agreed to keep coordinating and possibly for the next steps. You have at the same time Senator Lindsey Graham. He's someone who has supported Ukraine for a long time. He's also someone who's very close to Donald Trump. He was in Turkey. He briefed the Europeans on a packet of sanctions that he's apparently preparing in Congress if Russia doesn't come to the negotiating table in a good faith. So they're preparing, and there are people in a Trump world that are pushing him to be more aggressive on Russia. Even though it doesn't fit with the MAGA view, there are still some hawks on Capitol Hill. And I actually, when I was in Washington, because I think we were all in Washington a couple of weeks ago, I met with one representative very close to Donald Trump, and his team was telling me that their strategy is to not to go the way of Vladimir Putin doesn't want peace, but go to Donald Trump's character and tell him that Vladimir Putin is playing him. Mm-hmm. And you saw that strategy actually play out yesterday when Vladimir Zelensky, I think it was yesterday or today, said, not only is it disrespectful to us not to show up, he said, we know that they have no respect for the Ukrainians. He said, it's disrespectful to Donald Trump. So it seems that the strategy also of Zelensky is to increasingly publicly state this idea that Vladimir Putin is playing Donald Trump, which is something anyone who's watched and followed Donald Trump over the years knows that that is not going to sit well if Donald Trump actually believes it.
And briefly, it's worth saying 85 million people seem to have been played this week. Boards are very interesting. You must have seen this. One of the viral stories of wild cocaine conspiracy this week, suggesting the German, the French, British leaders were on a train hiding a stash and a spoon too. Here it is. It turned out to be a tissue and a cocktail stirring stick, but it does prove a point, doesn't it? The Elysee putting out a statement saying, be vigilant of France's enemies spreading disinformation. What do you make of that?
Hey, I think it would probably, if it were true, it would probably improve their image, probably increase their numbers. Kind of cool guy sitting there hanging out, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's the curse of social media, really. The irresponsibility of these platforms. They are gatekeepers, yet they reject their role as gatekeepers. They want to replace news media, and they're destroying news media and traditional news media outlets. But they have shown zero responsibility except when under great pressure and threats of legal repercussions.
I also want to move on briefly to a... an issue we can't miss because it's one of the biggest cultural moments for film of the whole year this week in France, the 78th year of the Cannes Festival, kicking off with new red carpet rules, no nudity, no big gowns, no voluminous dresses, trip hazards, and people weren't fitting into their seats, apparently. The festival ushered in by surprise guest of honour, Quentin Tarantino. It opened politically with Robert De Niro taking aim at President Trump in an acceptance speech for his honorary Palme d'Or for Lifetime Achievement. We also heard from the jury paying tribute to the photojournalist Fatima Hassana, who told her own story of working and living under siege in Gaza for the documentary Put Your Soul in Your Hand and Walk, chosen to premiere as an independent cinema choice at the festival. She was killed by an Israeli airstrike the day after finding out the film had been selected. Janine, a quick word from you. A letter gone round tonight that many actors have petitioned to say that we can't ignore what's going on in the middle of this award ceremony.
Photographer.
Yes, I saw your photos.
Hollywood actors were terrified to speak out about Gaza. And now, you know, if you look online, more and more of them are speaking out saying, okay.
No, we hear you. We hear you, Janine. Carry on.
We hear you, Janine. Carry on.
Sorry, I didn't think. No, I think this is another real change, along with Tom Friedman and, you know, people speaking out more. A year ago, Jamie Lee Curtis, Steven Spielberg, a whole host of Jewish American actors and actresses signed a petition supporting Israel. Now that has changed. More and more actors are no longer afraid that they were originally told you won't get roles, scriptwriters wouldn't be able to sell their scripts. People are speaking out more and more now. It's the fear that they would be canceled is in some way lessening. I'm not saying it still exists. Look at the students being deported for speaking out, the NYU student whose diploma was taken away from him. But I feel that in terms of Hollywood, people are gaining courage and they're standing up on the stage and they're saying, this must stop. People are being killed in Gaza, starved to death, burnt and bombed.
Janine, always good to hear your view. I just want, on the wider point, you have 20 seconds, Richard, to send us off into a nice weekend. Your view on this new position, a ban on nudity, a ban on long train dresses, what do you think?
Well, ban on nudity, when I saw some of the dresses of actresses, especially one French actress who is playing alongside Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, I have my doubt. It seemed to me, I asked at the beginning of this program how you say décolleté in English, and I got two words, cleavage from Kate Evans and décolletage from you. So it seems to me that the décolletage is still quite visible, but I don't know exactly the norms.
Always good to hear your thoughts. Richard, thank you for your time. Richard Willey, author, long-time world affairs correspondent, European correspondent for Swiss media outlet Blick. To my panel from Istanbul, three-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, international correspondent Borzu Daragahi. In Kyiv, Janine De Giovanni, renowned war correspondent, author, CEO of The Reckoning Project, and our international affairs editor, Ketevan Gorgiasoni. Thank you all. And a quick word, the coveted prize for Cannes, still to be revealed. We'll leave you with Tom Cruise on the Cannes Quasset, talking about the last Mission Impossible movie, The Final Reckoning. Very interesting. We will see you, I hope. Thank you for watching. Your mission, should you choose to accept, it is to join us in 7 days for The World Next Week.
I need you to trust me one last time.